everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and Phil Brining. Hello.
Hello.
This week's session was a GDPR radio, and we covered so much ground. I think it's a good job we had a lot of, you know, so much to pick up on, but it was really interesting, and you know, it took quite a few different avenues, from cybercrime to legislation to Phil's trip to Barcelona that is no longer happening. What were your highlights?
I think for me, I know it was one of the discussions I started, but I just quite, because I raised it because I liked doing the work on it, which was looking at the lookalike audiences and the Google Performance Max that one of our customers is considering using. I think that, you know, was good because it then morphed into talking about other lookalike audience, you know, techniques. And, you know, I know we're talking next week about profiling and tracking and things, but, you know, it's a fascinating area, and particularly as it's driven by AI. And we talked about, you know, what would that actually mean for responding to subject access requests and writing privacy information. You know, because our conclusion was that I'm not convinced that, you know, it's easy to get under the skin of what the AI is actually doing. So how are you going to explain the logic? What did you think, Joe? What was your highlights?
Yeah, I did enjoy talking about that because it's been with my customer, so that's been something I've had to get my teeth under this week. I enjoyed the conversation around 23andMe and how they're potentially, you know, on the brink of going bust and what they're going to do with a mass amount of genetic data that they've got. And then towards the end of the session, we touched on a couple of fines that have happened over the recent week or so, and obviously touching back on the PSNI breach. That was an incredibly serious one, wasn't it, at the summer last year. So nice to see that something's finally come of that. And I think it might lead to someone putting in a FOIA request to find out what the ICO has been doing with public sector organisations under its public sector approach. So if I put that in, I'll update you if I get a response on that.
What highlight, Jasmine, do you highlight any highlights?
Yeah,
for you?
I really enjoyed talking about you know, what happens if a processor turns around and decides to keep data that they've been provided by the controller. I thought that was a really interesting discussion and a complicated one, but yeah, it doesn't sit quite right with me regardless of what you say, Phil. Might have to lodge a complaint and see what the ICO says, or I could just use the chat, but I suppose
Now, I was going to mention that on Monday I've got a meeting to start looking at the internal workings of parking meters, which would be with Kenny, which would be interesting. I know you're looking quizzically at me, like, but I'll all be revealed next Friday, but that's one of my highlights on Monday is the internal workings of a parking meeting in a parking meter.
Yeah, it sounds exciting, Phil. But yeah, we'll let you get stuck into the main part of the session. We will be back next week for a session on tracking and profiling, so that'll be quite a fresh insight into data protection, and you know, there'll be a lot to unpack there. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoy the session. Upon arrival. So yeah, let's make a start anyway. How have your weeks been?
That's a good question. I have a quick look through what I've been quite busy doing all sorts of, running around doing all sorts of stuff this week. So a bit of a bitty week, to be honest. What about you,
Joe?
All right, thanks, Jasmine. Yeah, no, the same as Phil. I feel like my weeks were always a little bit bitty, and every Friday you ask me how's my week been, and I can never remember what I've been doing. So I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
Yeah, I'm meant to be going to Barcelona next week for the European meeting for the PCI.
That's all right for some.
DSS. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And the European meeting, that famous one.
Yeah. Well, and I had planned to go off today or yesterday, actually, because it's an extended kind of, you've got to get orientated around Barcelona and stuff like that, but yeah, I don't think I'll have time. But in my diary it says main aim for this week is PC. I've got to do my retraining and requalification exam by the 17th of October, and I haven't even started it this week, so I think I'm not going to go to Barcelona, and I will be doing all that next week. Oh. My retraining, I know, the things I have to do, to sacrifices I make, Jasmine.
I do actually feel sorry for you there. It's quite a change.
That's quite sad, yeah. So rather than going to Barcelona, you're going to be revising for an exam you've got to sit.
I've got to do a day's refresher course. But of course, the last time I did the exam was on version 3.2.1, and now it's on version 4.0.1. So I've got to do the retraining, which is going to take a day. And it's so dull. It's the dullest thing ever, ever, ever. And then I've got to do some revision, and then I've got the exam to do.
To be next week?
Well, I've got the week after to do as well after that. If I don't do it by the 17th, I think I'll get a 30-day warning, and then ultimately I'd lose my QSA badge if I didn't do it. So I need to do
No, because I remember you when you last did it, you saying for weeks, oh yeah, I need to do that. Oh yeah, I'm planning on doing it next week. And I was thinking, this is ever going to get done?
I moan about it all every year. I mean, it's a good exercise. And I think every time I do it, I say, there ought, again, my view, there ought really to be some kind of requalification confirmation type of thing for DPOs. If the IAP said you've got to do an annual refresher course and to retain your badge, I think that would be a good thing, because it forces me to review everything in PCIDSS and do a one-day course, and I think that's a good thing despite me not liking doing it. But of course, now I've said to people, I might not be going to Barcelona, everyone's trying to shove things in my diary for next week, so I'll probably say next Friday, say no, next week
I'm doing stuff for your QSA. I've actually just remembered what I've been up to this week. I've had I've had some calls with customers who have been having some issues with some organisations that they engage with, whether it's providing a service or kind of like controller to controller kind of like relationships. But it's the customers I've been working with have been running into issues with the third parties, and I'm just absolutely gobsmacked the amount of data protection teams within organizations that don't know the law. They're restricting the disclosure of data to our customers, saying that they can't do it because of the GDPR, but that's not the case. I still can't wrap my head around why people think that the GDPR restricts you from doing things. It doesn't. It just tells you, in order to do this, you have to do certain things.
Yeah, in the main, there's a few things it prohibits, but there's not much it prohibits,
No, and it's just I just find it not concerning. Just, the GDPR has been around for six years now. Well, no, 2016 was it, the GDPR, the EU GDPR came in? Data Protection Act of 2018.
Yeah.
So, it's a fair amount of time for people to, hopefully, you'd think, to get their head around the law and understand what you need to do.
It's not new, Joe. It's been around since 1984.
Well, but if you want to go further back, does data protection kind of like principles and stuff date back from like the 1800s? Is that not what you taught us
it goes back a long way. The Statute of Anne is the first kind of legislation to try and regulate. Ooh, that was copyright, though, but it goes back a long way. Long further than people think, but... in fact, interestingly, I was listening to this podcast on the BBC when I've been driving around on BBC Sounds, and it's about this the kidnapping of Rupert Murdoch's financial director's wife back in the 60s, and she got mistaken identity. She got kidnapped. Yeah, she got kidnapped and murdered. But because it was the newspaper tycoon's family, the newspapers, the tabloids got really involved. And that reminded me that, the kind of the precursor to all the data protection law in the UK was all this sort of fight in the press, and there was the Princess Anne got some press intrusion, and the Munich air disaster. The press got in there and interviewing the players and Sir Matt Busby, in their hospital beds. That was one of the drivers for the data protection in the UK, was curbing the press, not protecting people's rights, curbing the press.
Stop the press being nosy. But isn't there a journalism curbing the exemption?
Rights of, there is in this current law, but that was one of the main drivers. Anyway, the government set up, you probably know all this, government set up some committee. We talked about it last week, because somebody corrected me or didn't correct, filled in the gap, my mind went blank. But the Younger Committee was the first one. She came up with 10 principles, many of which... In fact, all of which, I think, are in the current, law. So that's back in 72, made those recommendations. And Lindop in 1978 was suggesting setting up a regulator, and then we kind of sat on our heels a bit until Thatcher pushed through the 84 Act in order to not lose pace with Europe.
Really, happen now with AI, by the looks of it.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of all that. Now, an interesting thing happened to me. Did I mention that I had to go on a speed awareness course the other week?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Well, I got a text message this week saying from the DSA Fixed Penalty Office. This is a text message saying, you have not paid your ticket within the stipulated time. Today is the last time to notify you to pay. We will ban your car from the road, from driving on the road starting tomorrow, and transfer your parking ticket to the court. And I'm just wondering whether there's been a leak at either West Yorkshire Police, where I got clocked, or at the training provider, Hartlepool Borough Council. So I'm going to raise it with them and just find out, is it random, or is that something that, you know, how do they know I've got a fixed penalty notice?
Mm-hmm. Where's that come from?
To send me that text. Well, just a random text message, but it says, now click here to pay your ticket. Well, that's going to be some kind of phishing exercise, isn't it? It's an absolute con. But I'm just wondering how they've selected my number to send me this text.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. That you'll have to let us know what they say.
Yeah.
I had that a few weeks ago when I booked a hotel on Booking.com. Like immediately after, like really soon after, I got an email. I can't remember exactly what it was about, but it didn't add up with normal email confirmation, and it made me question it, and it was obviously a phishing attempt, and I just thought, well, probably need to change my password there. But then it just got me thinking about all of the passwords that have been leaked, and all the accounts I've got. You can check, is it on your phone, you can check, and then on websites as well. And I just didn't, to be honest. Yeah. Probably should do that.
It looks like other people have had this same text as me. I don't know if you've all been on the speed awareness courses as well, or whether
that's what I was thinking. Quite a few of our listeners and hosts have been breaking speeding laws. Or I wonder if the text was just sent out to a broad range of people, and just by chance, Phil, you happen to be going for a speed awareness course at some point. So
coincidence.
Oh yeah, Carol said that. Funny thing, I've received the same exact text. However, I had no fines, tickets, or speeding offences. Maybe it was a leak of some sort at the DVLA. Maybe just another catch-all phone scam.
It must. It's just funny time in the DVLA. I think it must be just firing this out to mobile phone numbers from a database that they've obviously obtained. I don't think there'd be anything to do with DVLA, but the wording was funny though. Today we will ban your car from driving on the road. Yeah, that sounds like official DVLA type of language, doesn't it?
Zara would have fallen for that one. She got a call once. What was it, Joe? You were in the office.
There was
a warrant out for arrest.
Yeah, Zara got a call from HMRC, and they were threatening her on the phone saying there's a warrant out for arrest. And me, Jasmine, and Miles were just sat there like, just hang up, like the HMRC don't warrant.
Hide under the desk. Yeah. But there's lots of these obviously scams. I mean, a lot of people fall for them, I think.
I was gonna say, that
especially with
something.
The timing of it as well.
Yeah, like Phil, if you weren't kind of not say all there, like if you weren't up to if you weren't on the ball, let's say, you could very well have easily fallen for that, couldn't you? So it's
well, I shan't bother then to waste West Yorkshire Police and DVLA and Hartlepool Council's time. Then I shall put that down to coincidence.
I got one the other day, and it was quite unsettling actually, because it's something that it's probably obvious that this information is out there somewhere if you look for it. But I got an email with my name in it, my email address, and my phone number. It was a scam email. And then there was like an click here to opt out of these emails, but it felt really threatening, that they had all this information together, and it almost made me want to click on the link, and I thought, don't be stupid, but I think there would be a lot of people who would probably go down that route. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, changing the subject, next week I meant to be at a Salesforce event, this PCI event in Barcelona, and I'd like to go to the ICO's annual data protection conference. I put in a link here, people. I wasn't really aware of it, to be honest. It was on next week. It's on then Tuesday. And last time I went was a long time ago, because it's very, very hard to get tickets for it. But this is all online this time. So I've put a link in. I wasn't aware it was on next Tuesday. So I've put a link in case other people aren't aware that it's on next Tuesday. But that link there is just so if you wanted to go, you can register for the event. I don't know what sessions are on, and sometimes it's a bit of a hit and miss conference. Sometimes it's been brilliant, and there've been other times where it's nothing new, same old, kind of repetitive exercise. So don't know what it'll be like. They've not been for a few years, so I might just attend this one on Tuesday, virtually, and see what it's like.
Is it a case of just dropping in sessions? Is it? Can you just like sign up and then just join the ones that you kind of
Yeah, I think so, Joe.
Take your fancy.
Yeah, I think so. I think you can sign up. I've signed up, and I think you can either, you know, not even bother showing up, as a lot of people probably do, you know, don't, as things might crop up. But I think you can just drop in and out of the sessions. If it's all digitally remote, then it's much easier for them to allow people to, you know, haven't got room capacity to think about, have they?
No, I might have to sign up for that and see if there's anything in there that takes me fancy. I was just going to say on that, do you know if it's online? I wonder how they're combating with like things like Otter AI and stuff, if people are joining and it's taking notes.
Oh, that's going to be interesting to see, won't it?
Yeah, because obviously it takes screen grabs, doesn't it, of the whole thing. And I know people have the cameras off, right? But it has personal names. It has names on. Do I have? Oh, no, surely they'd hide everyone's names who are listening. If it's
you can do that where it just shows the speakers.
It would be interesting if people do send in these read bots. Be interesting, wouldn't it?
They probably do, because I think they're set automatically to a lot. So
they are,
unless they have some technology that prevents it, maybe.
Yeah,
I suppose that's the only realistic way around it.
Yeah, because I didn't click anything for Otter AI to join any of my Teams call. I just created an Otter account to try and have a look what it was capturing. And in doing so, the next time I joined the podcast, it said that I'd sent a bot into here to take notes. So it doesn't do what I say it to do. It's kind of just goes off on its own.
Yeah.
And does what it wants.
Now, you mentioned, Jasmine, that there was the PDP conference last week. I've been to that a couple of times, and that is usually a really, really good conference with lots of really good speakers.
Yeah, I got an email this week, with some summaries of what was discussed, and it seemed like it was really interesting. I think you can find recordings of it or I don't know, written up notes and so on from it, I'm not sure, but I only saw some blurbs from it around children's data and international transfers and AI. It looks quite good.
Fiona said that
she attended. I've
been to one or two of theirs, and they are good, expensive. Well, they used to be expensive. There's another one I'm very tempted to go to, which I put a link into as well, in November, 28th of November. It's physically in London or digitally remote, and that's Westminster Insight. But it looks quite an interesting agenda. You know, they're talking about some of these new bills and, some interesting topics on developments in direct marketing, online advertising, cookies, pecker privacy. You know, they always read well, don't they? And you get there and not quite living up to expectations. But I'm quite tempted to go down to it. It's about £390 to go. For the day, maybe, you know, it's end of November, Christmas shopping. Who said that?
I do like London that time of year. It's very good.
Yeah. Oh, fairness saying it was a lot to take away. It's good. Yeah, that's what you want, isn't it? You want to go along. I think we're attending risk, aren't we? As a business. But what I like about these things, you go along and if you're out of the office, you're in a different kind of mindset, and you just kind of think differently and absorb things more differently, I think, when I'm at these types of events. Anyway, everyone's got their own way of learning, haven't they, I suppose?
No, I'll be interested to see what is discussed really on the Digital Information and Smart Data Bill, because I don't know if it's just me not looking into it, but I don't feel like there's that much information around it yet. But we were talking earlier, Phil, weren't we, about the digital ID online verification? So you hadn't heard of that, had you?
No, I've not. I mean, to be honest, I don't. Apart from the digital DDI bill, I don't pay. Haven't paid that much attention to bills, because there's been such a lot of them, and you know. And towards the end of the last government, you thought, well, you know, is it going to get through? Is it going to get parliamentary time? Are they going to? Which obviously didn't do in the end. But I mean, we're in the early days of this parliament, so you know, there's a good chance that this one might get through. But I don't pay that much attention to the bills, to be honest.
Yeah, is that what this is, Jasmine? The smart data bill, is that like the DP? Is that Labour's version of the DPDI, or is it just a completely separate?
But as far as I'm aware, there's a slight less focus on personal data, I think.
Is it
as the previous bill was with under the Conservative government? So I think there will be some things that are taken from it, like when we spoke, was it last week, about the Department for Work and Pensions being given or granted the powers to access people's accounts, whether indirectly or directly. Obviously that was proposed initially or previously, but that's going to be under a different bill, fraud related bill. So I think it's dispersed a little bit, but at the same time, there are some remnants of it.
So is it like designed to potentially replace the UK GDPR then, or is it going to kind of supplement?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's supplementary.
So there were a couple of areas that were referenced in relation to personal data and data protection at this point, which relates to the online ID, the digital verification, and then there might have been something else I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, I didn't realise that this had been something in discussion, this online ID with European Commission for over a year now. I didn't realise. So I think it was someone from Big Brother's Watch, as I could be wrong, but State Watch and several other rights organisations, they signed an open letter calling for the European Data Protection Board to evaluate the potential human rights risks posed by the new UN Convention on Cybercrime. That's it. So this is in relation to digital ID wallets, I think it is. And basically they're talking about the risks around this. Oh, no, sorry, right. That's the wrong one. I'm talking about the wrong one. That's related to the Online Safety Act and encryption. Ignore me for a minute.
Right. I don't know if you saw the press yet, but Boris Johnson is proposing to, which, you know, he's obviously in the minority now in terms of the political party, but they're proposing to have a referendum on the EHCR membership. Again, that would be interesting. You know, a referendum, last time we had a referendum, it went, well, we won't go there. If we had a referendum and let's say that the country was persuaded because of small boats to vote us out of the EHCR, it'd have a massive impact on what we do, you know, data protection rights, fundamental rights and freedoms, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I can't imagine, you know, people voting to...
I don't think people know what it is. And Boris has been saying, oh, it wouldn't undermine any of our rights we've already got somewhere else, you know, which is probably nonsense. But, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, people read the, you know, £330 million every day coming back into the NHS type of slogans and say, yeah, that sounds a good thing to vote for.
Yeah, but this...
Stop the small boats, jump out the EHCR.
I know. No, I can see the headlines. But even still, I think, you know, there was such distaste to the Rwanda policy and so on that I can't see. Obviously, there is a lot of, a lot of mixed opinion on immigration and the government's approach to it. But I don't know. I think that's probably a step too far if that's where we're left, if we're to leave that convention or remove ourselves from it.
I think one of the candidates, is it Jenrick has said, or is it one of them has said that he will definitely push for a referendum, and the other three have said they won't. But I mean, they're obviously the minority, so it might never happen. But just interesting to think about, if it does go through, you know, where does that leave our data protect, the kind of the reputation of our data protection law and its standing? Now, have you done anything interesting this week? One of the most interesting things,
I mean, that's still, you know, you can then compare that to if we were to change our data protection laws and lose adequacy with the EU, that would then have its, you know, own commercial effects. So I think that would probably be.
Nah, we'd be all right. We're a sovereign nation. We can carve our own path.
Yeah. Anyway, clearly.
Yeah.
I'd just like to go back to that news piece that I explained terribly and got confused. So. Basically, what I read was that 500 million people are predicted to be using digital identity wallets by 2026. So this is across the EU. So this is in relation to the EIDAS regulation, EIDAS, I don't know. This is the first I've heard of it, but there's been talks around it since last year. And it made me think about our digital ID proposals.
Yeah, aren't these the new regulations at the border where we've got to give our biometric data over from, it keeps getting pushed back. It was meant to be this October, wasn't it? I think that's IDAS, isn't it?
Potentially. But yeah, I just, so there were a couple of comments on this and I thought it was quite interesting because when I first heard about digital ID, I thought that You know, it's a worry. Where's it going to be stored? How secure is it going to be, etc.? And then I thought of it from another perspective, where if we all have our own digital ID, I suppose, card, and that was, you know, used to for whatever different, you know, checks that are needed, whether it's with housing or whether it's, I don't know, another example, where you would provide that already. You know, if you think about it, currently you'd provide a picture of your passport and then a picture of yourself, for example, to make sure that they marry up. And then that private company, a lot of the time, would store that data. You don't know what's done with it after that. Whereas if there was measures in place to be able to verify yourself with this digital ID, and then that organization didn't then store it, you know, it is limiting how far your data is going in some ways, and it's probably, you know, much more controlled, and obviously it'd be centralized.
Yeah, so I was thinking of ETIAS, which is a EU travel information and authorization system, but that's where we're going to have to give our fingerprints to as well as our passports to get through into Europe, the Schengen area.
All right. Oh yeah. I read that the other day, actually.
Yeah. Which keeps getting pushed back. You prompted a thought which has escaped my Cullender-like brain. But anyway, have you done anything interesting this week? I think probably one of the most interesting things I've done was with Joe. We were looking at a customer rang us and asked us if we had any thoughts on them using Google. What was it called, Joe? It was
Performance Max.
And I had not heard of Google Performance Max, so we had to do a little bit of digging and catching up. But what it seems to do, according to the customer, is they basically load a database of their supporters. It's a voluntary charitable organization. They load a list of their supporters into Google, which uses their AI to anonymize the data, profile the data, which I think they've got it the wrong way around. It must profile it first. I'll come on to that in a minute. Profile it first, then AI, and then anonymize it. And then compare those profiles with the rest of its database system and find lookalikes, people who look like, we've got somebody who probably knows more about it than I do, lookalikes. And then, you know, they'll present display ads to those lookalike audiences. Yes, please, David, come on in if you want to have a talk about it.
No, I was quite interested in where would you get the processing power to actually and the consent to do that? And I mean, and the lawful basis to actually do this comparison, because I'm sure they're going to inform every single member that does this that what they're planning to do with the fair processing notice. It's just sort of one of those things. I probably put my hand up a little bit prematurely, actually, so I'll let you continue.
No, to be fair, have you heard about it? I mean, I've not heard about it. I mean, it doesn't look like ordinances before Adobe Marketplace and some others. LinkedIn does the same. They all do it. Had you heard about it before, David?
I think it's just everyone jumping on the bandwagons because AI is the thing to do, and everybody is trying to now embed it into their applications to make it new and sexy. And I think it's short term game, and it's going to come back and bite us. Because I mean, when we actually do due diligence on a lot of this, a lot of the applications that before we use them within the organization, the charity I work for, we've now got a whole new area to look at of, you know, are they going to be data scraping? Are they going to be learning what are the algorithms behind the AI? Is this going to pose a risk to our data?
Yeah, and it is absolutely spot on. And this is where Joe and I were kind of getting to with this discussion, dive in. Anybody else, including Joe and Jasmine, if you've got things you want to raise to influence the discussion. But I was thinking, well, how can you anonymize it, then profile it? Because you surely need to go off. You get an email address, I'm assuming. You then have to go off and find all the behavioral stuff around that email address and then anonymize it. So you have this profile information. This person's browsing habits are like this. You know, we estimate their age to be like that based on all these other things. You can't do that with anonymized data. You have to be able to do that with identifiable data. Then you might anonymize it, so you've only got like the profile. Then you look for similar profiles, and then you find the whatever cookies, email addresses of those people. But though if it was display ads, when somebody logged on to, you know, a search engine, then it would find the cookie, say, right, this profile matches this, and we've been paid by this charity to do this work, right? They'll present this charity's advert to this individual, because, you know, there's a good chance that they're similar to the charity's data set.
So is it data shared, I suppose, Google's data that's shared rather than...
Well, it's not shared as such. So the charity will share its data with Google. Google won't tell you back, oh, these are the people to target. They'll just target it for you, target them for you.
But within their existing customer base or...
No.
Shall I give a little bit more context?
Oh, right.
Go on, Joe.
So the data protection team at the organisation have their concerns around it. It comes from the marketing and the fundraising department, who think that... So what they've got is the people whose data they're going to upload into Google is people who have previously consented to direct marketing. And the marketing and fundraising team are saying, oh, we've already got consent for that, for direct marketing. So they'll be completely fine with us uploading people's email addresses into Google in order to then find people who have similar like browsing patterns, I guess, in order to then to provide them with a target ad. So that's the way it works. It's the customers at the organization have already consented to direct marketing. I know there's issues around that, because obviously consent's got to be specific, and they're probably not going to be okay with you then uploading their emails into Google just because you've consented to direct marketing. But once the email is like loaded into Google, I suspect, as Phil says, Google will then find that, use that email, have a look at its browsing history, anonymize it, and then it will find, and I think it's people within like the same geographical area. So
that'd be one of the settings you can say. Yeah, you could say, I want this geo and I want,
So say it took mine, it will anonymize me, use my browsing history to find people who are within the area of Leeds who have similar browsing patterns as me to then send target ads.
I think it would do it the other way around. I think it would say, like, Joe Kirk, we estimate is mid-20s, we estimate is income to be this, we estimate his profession to be that, we estimate the interests to be this, and the next thing, you know, the charitable giving is, you know, dogs, cats and hamsters. Right, okay, let's anonymize it now and find other people who've got, you know, 24, live in this geo, got this type of professional structure, give to dog, cats and hamsters charities. Right, we found Jasmine. When Jasmine next logs on, there's a big display ad saying, you know, give to hamsters, because they think that you're two as similar. I mean, there's probably a gender split in there as well, and all sorts of different, you know, profiling components. But I think the anonymization must happen after the profiling by Google to find, you know, the target profiles.
Yeah.
Because they've got to go off and find your browsing history.
Do they have to share their customer or donor or data?
Yeah, otherwise you can't find who the lookalikes are.
Just give a list of, you know, what you're looking for, or is it more advanced than that, I suppose?
Yeah, it's a lot more advanced than that, yeah.
Than them being aware, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot more advanced than that. But, I mean, it begs the question, not only about privacy information, which Dave has mentioned, but, you know, how would you respond, and this is topical, because there was a story in the news this week, and I can't remember which one, where, you know, you get a subject action request and you're obliged to explain the logic in any automated processing. Well, how do you do that if you don't understand it or you haven't got it documented? I mean, Joe, I think your response to the client was, you really need to do a DPIA on this. Firstly, you know, it's merging data. Secondly, it could be invisible processing. Thirdly, I can't remember what else we said, but we had three or four things. It ticked on the ICO's list of, this is potentially high risk, you've got to do a DPIA. Mm. But that was quite fun, actually, looking at that. And what it led to me to look at, which is always a good thing to look back at the guidance, was the ICO direct marketing guidance, because they have a whole page about lookalike audiences, which is good, on page 91 of their data direct marketing code of practice. It's really good to go back, because I wouldn't have otherwise gone over it and looked at it again. But, you know, you kind of open up that direct marketing. Oh, I remember this. You know, 2020, you scoot through it. Oh, right, yeah, I remember him saying that, you know. And It's quite good to get these abstract things to look at, because it forces you back into the guidance. And then from there, I looked at the working party guidance on DPIAs as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. And also on the ICO's direct marketing code of practice in relation to lookalike audience, it actually said that the relationship would be that of a joint controllership, didn't it?
Yeah.
Opens up other avenues of to kind of like who's the one responsible for providing with privacy information. Obviously, when it gets shared with Google, are Google obligated to provide privacy information because they've collected it from a third party other than directly from the data subject? Or is it just, would it be sufficient for the customer just to provide privacy information and say that we will share the information with Google in order to do targeted ads to lookalike audiences?
I think it would have to be both in this instance. But, I mean, especially with, you know, Google being such a large organization anyway, yeah. But with, I think, you know, with something so technical, it'd be silly for Google to assume that other organizations would explain this process in sufficiently for one, but yeah, also it's the organization's customer base, for example, that, yeah. You know, that the sharing or processing.
Yeah, it's cracking, isn't it, really? Because, I mean, you know, the joint controller, my head is, you know, the joint controller is something that you collaborate on, and then, but this isn't, you're buying a product, aren't you? So, you know, you're right, we're going to do this, buy this lookalikes thing, and there's no negotiation with Google about it. You're like, buy the products, and there's no collaboration on who's going to do what, who's going to respond to rights requests, who's going to be responsible for privacy information, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, there's the product, buy it, and we'll execute it for you. And it was quite interesting to look at and think about. We enjoyed that kind of stuff, digging
well,
about.
We'll talk about it more next week as well, because we've got a session on tracking and profiling, so quite on brand. And then 2 weeks after that on AI, so.
Oh, right.
I think. Am I right with that, Joe?
I think so.
Yeah.
So,
I'm sure you are. I'm sure you're spot on. Have you done anything interesting this week, you know, in terms of looking at cases? We had a ransomware attack. One of our clients had a ransomware attack a couple of weeks ago as well. So that is rumbling on. Suzanne's dealing with that and advising on that. But again, that's been quite painful for the company that's had it. You know, systems have been interesting. That came via LinkedIn, actually. There's I can't remember the exact circumstances, but an email came in for a job application and it got bounced around various director of the business. It ended up with one of the directors clicked on it, downloaded an executable file, and that was it. Boom, everything got locked down, and 40 gigabytes of data was exfiltrated. So they've got the forensic IT guys in, and I'm not entirely sure. My initial stance was quite aggressive in a way, saying, well, you know, the forensic people can't tell you what's gone, you know, when it went, how it went, you know, why? You know, I would have thought the ICO would be saying, why don't you know what's gone? You know, and they were saying, oh, we're going to restore it. Don't worry, we can restore it from backups. So if you can restore it from backups, presumably you can identify what's gone. But anyway, that was another interesting one that I've had a look at this week and last week.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I think that your news piece, Phil, around ransomware and the ICO, which shows that over the last four years or so, there's been at least 3,760 ransomware incidents that have been reported to the ICO. And within this, two have been resulted in a fine to the organisation. So there was the Tucker's Solicitors, which received a £98,000 fine in 2022, and Interserve, who received a £4.4 million fine also in 2022. Oh, and then another one, sorry, Advanced Computer Software Group, who received a £6 million provisional fine in August this year. So I found that really interesting. You know, what approach are they taking with that? Is it that, you know, the ICO are deciding they're not fining for cyberware attacks, ransomware attacks, or
well, that's how it
they're
looks,
not investigating?
That's how it looks. Yeah, interesting article, which I'll put in here, because said to Suzanne, fire this off to your customer just to kind of help reassure them in a way. But this is written by, I can't remember which law firm, but one of the London law firms, I believe. And they were saying, you know, the odds are the ICO is not going to fine for ransomware attacks unless what they're finding is that actually enough basics are in place. And this was something that was potentially avoidable, but down to human error, notwithstanding training and cybersecurity awareness, you know, so one of those things that would have happened despite all the best efforts of the controller to put in place appropriate security. But that was quite interesting to kind of for this article to reach that conclusion.
Yeah, I just find it strange that out of those the number of ransomware incidents that, you know, they will have all had sufficient measures in place, and it won't have, you know, there wouldn't have been any negligence or lack of
maybe it's just hard to prove. I think one of the common points in the article is, you know, maybe it's just so hard to prove the ICO to to prove to the extent they can get a conviction through or an enforcement action through.
What gives the ICO the powers to fine organisations for ransomware incidents? Is it?
Well, it's a breach of the GDPR. You know, so GDPR gives an opportunity to fine, levy monetary penalty notices, and you know, for non-compliance with the GDPR, and they'd have to demonstrate that it was a breach of security. You know, that was to inadequate measures or inappropriate measures, or you know, measures that weren't tested, or you know, but because GDPR is so woolly on security, you know, putting what you think what's appropriate, you know, even policies, if appropriate, how would a policy not be appropriate? But I mean, it's there, isn't it? So they'd have to demonstrate that they thought it was due to, you know, negligence, really.
That's probably why then, though, that the ICO has been kind of so lackluster in terms of ransomware, because the whole general approach around finding under the GDPR is it's not something that they really tend to exercise. You tend to see it a lot more with PECA, don't you? And PECA, I think, is a lot more kind of it's evident because it's there, isn't it? Whereas trying to fine organisations for non-compliance with the UK GDPR, as you said, Phil, is just a lot harder to prove.
I was looking to try and find the breach form, just because Petra is saying, oh, that's scary with the CV. I was wanting to, which I, if I can't find it, I'll have to go through it next week, just to run through, you know, actually the sequence of events that led to the ransomware attack. But it was somebody who had applied for a job and it had come round the directors. And because it had been forwarded on by the MD to somebody else, you know, maybe everyone assumed that everybody else had done sufficient due diligence and checked on it. But when it was clicked on, the link was clicked on, it launched an .exe file, and that caused all the damage.
They weren't from Know Before, were they?
No, we don't know.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking about that that employee that applied, that I suppose was offered
the
a job.
The North Korean. Yeah.
The North Korean. Yeah, that's what I mean.
good point.
But yeah, I mean, I suppose it is difficult with ransomware breaches, because I don't think nearly any organizations are completely safe from them, really. You know,
it's human error.
Well, there's human error, and then I think that, you know, there's sophistication of your technology as well, which can be such a tricky thing, especially for smaller organizations. You know, don't have the budget, but
We talked briefly last week about kind of work around multi-factor authentication, and there's again some interesting expression that I found some more stuff, you know, this week about it. I'll put another link into it, but you know, this again article I've read is kind of setting out, you know, how multi-factor authentication attacks are orchestrated, you know, which is, you know, the most vulnerable is when you're using text messages or emails to kind of do that additional factor. And you know, it's key loggers and it's things like that that are, you know, able to intercept the multi-factor authentication piece. The conclusion is, you know, this is still technology worth having, but you know, it isn't as bulletproof as you think it is. I'll put that in the link now, because last week, somebody said, oh, let's have a read about that. So that's a further reading to do.
Yeah, have you seen that Sellafield have been fined for cybersecurity breaches on that topic, actually? So they've been fined just short of £333,000 for, I think, 4 shortfalls.
Right.
But this fine comes from the Office for Nuclear Regulation. So I wonder if it's something that the ICO would follow up on or not. Probably not.
Well, who's fined them?
The Office for Nuclear Regulation.
So
again, the nuclear regulator.
Yeah, one would have thought that they'd also be culpable under the Network and Information Systems Regulations, and also potentially the GDPR as well. So that might be worth keeping an eye on how that pans out.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I want to spin the conversation on its head with a story that I've seen. So going away from cyber, did you guys see that 23andMe is on the brink of collapse?
I did. Again, that's worrying, isn't it?
It's very worrying. And for those that aren't aware, 23andMe are a organisation that take data from people. So DNA, isn't it? I think in terms
like
of
my heritage.
Ancestry links. So apparently the company's valuation has plummeted 99% from its 6 billion peak. Shortly after the company went public. And I just think there's a lot of questions in there around what they're going to do with the mass amount of data that they've got. Andy Kill, who's a spokesperson for 23andMe, would not comment on what the company might do with its trove of genetic data beyond general pronouncements about its commitment to privacy, saying that for our customers, our focus continues to be on transparency and choice over how they want their data be managed, he said. The company has an agreement with pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline that allows the drug maker to tap the tech company's customer data to develop new treatments for disease. But I think there's just some worry about what they're going to do with that data. I think it might be, because it's obviously it's an asset, it might be sold off, maybe even to law enforcement. So that's really quite concerning, isn't it? Especially with it being a US organization, the laws over there kind of, you know, your data subjects don't have as many rights, do they, as they have over here. So it'll be quite interesting to see kind of where that goes and what happens with the data.
Yeah, but with that, Joe, I mean, you could take all sorts of other similar parallels. So we mentioned about AI. You know, I read somewhere that, you know, this prediction of an AI bubble, like the dot-com bubble, at some point is going to burst. Where's all that data going to go? You know, so much data that's been, you know, created and collected and created, you know, and if a company goes bust that's got all this data, what happens? You know, it's an asset. The liquidators are going to sell it on, aren't they?
This is interesting. The data privacy framework, 23andMe are signed up to the data privacy framework. So all variations of it, the EU, US one, the Swiss one and the UK one. Obviously that will have to be considered within it as well, because, you know, we were talking earlier about how many different regulations across the US that they might have to comply with and how that'll be an absolute minefield. But at the same time, they're probably collecting data globally, you know, of individuals who are based globally, including the UK and the EU. Well, not clearly. It's obviously the case if they're signed up to the framework. So there's a lot to unpick there, really, in what they have to consider and what basis they collect that information on in the first place. Because, you know, does purpose limitation not come into that as well if they're going to sell that off to liquidators, the data? And I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. I had a conversation yesterday afternoon with somebody who was, we were talking about, you know, if they've got a processor that's processing data, and they want the organization that is this organization is a processor and they've got a controller that is saying we want you to delete the data, and they're saying actually we want to delete the data. So we had a quite interesting theoretical discussion around, well, you know, do you have to delete the data? You know, if you choose not to delete the data, then presumably, you know, you would just engage Article 14, tell all the data subjects we're now a control of your data. And you know, you just take on the obligations of being a controller, which the person I was talking to is quite happy to do. So I don't think the GDPR prohibits a processor from becoming a controller, providing that they stick to the rules. Again, I might be flying a kite there, but, you know, I thought, well, let's explore. My advice was explore that. First of all, explore the strength of the process agreement. Contact said, I wrote it. It's brilliant. It's bulletproof. So we'll just just have a look through and see if you can wangle it that actually, you know, given the activities you're doing, you may a part controller as well in some respects, but otherwise it's looking at, well, you know, can we lawfully co-opt that data and start using it, which is just storing it and processing it. It's nothing particularly innocuous, but
that doesn't sit right with me at all, because if you know, if somebody's providing their data on the basis of this is exactly how it's going to be, you know, stored and processed, then, you know, that's fine. But then it's obviously, you know,
well, if then I got hold of it,
yeah,
if I got hold of it and then I wrote to you and said, oh, by the way, Jasmine, I have got your personal data now, I obtained it from this organization and, you know, I'm doing this with it and these are, you know, qualified all the different parts of Article 14, would that be okay or not?
I think maybe, because it's one of them, isn't it, you know, the controller has shared it with the processor, so it's up to the processor if they're, you know, deciding to use it for the reasons they'll be liable for that. I suppose in that instance, all they could do is inform the data subjects and give them the option to keep processing, or if they want them to delete the data. I think that would probably be the best way around it.
You might find you're in breach of contract with your controller. Yeah. So again, there's kind of potential litigation there. But in terms of data protection law, again, it's just interesting to kind of think that through and say, well, does it feel right? You know, it doesn't feel right, but what in the law prohibits it from actually happening?
I think if you're going to do it, you'd probably have to give the data subject the chance to object to the processing.
Well, of course you do.
And I don't think you'd probably be able to argue that you have an overriding legitimate interest to kind of bat that away because the purpose has changed.
I think you're probably right. But let's say that a lot of people, you know, apply the normal diligence to reading privacy notices. You know, the chances are that, you know, most people won't object.
I think that's a slippery slope as well, though. If that was a case that went to, you know, to court, that would definitely be considered in you know, it'd have to be very refined on what basis you can do that. Otherwise, you get it happening all over the place and it'd just be a minefield.
But let's say that, you know, you went through, you did a rigorous work before deciding to do that, and you'd done legitimate interest assessments, you'd done a DPIA on it. You know, you'd addressed all the points, and then you said, right, I think we're probably okay. This is the problem we've all got as a community. You know, you don't know that you're wrong until you're told you're wrong by the regulator. You know, you read the law, interpret the law, you apply the controls, checks and balances around that. You think it's probably all right to do it, you know, but there's a chance it might not be. We'll do it. Then nobody knows about it for 10 years. Then somebody complains about it and you've been doing this wrong for 10 years. All right. Okay. Well, sorry.
Yeah. It is definitely an area where things creep out the woodworks constantly, you know, especially if it's, you know, you're looking into something and then something completely unrelated comes up and
that's what makes it fun.
Turns it upside down. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes it fun. Of course, the people we work with make it fun as well. But I mean, that unpredictability and that bit of unknown makes it a little bit edgy and fun as well.
Just one final point on that before we move on. In the data process agreement, should it not say though that the processor will delete or return the data at the end of the contract? So by then the processor becoming the controller, you're not adhering to that requirement of the DPA, are you?
Well, you'd be in breach of that contract.
Yeah.
So that might be litigation rather than, you know, GDPR violation.
Right. Would you not be infringing Article 28 that requires you to either delete or return the data?
Well, Article 28 requires you to have that as a contractual clause rather than to actually perform it, doesn't it?
Not actually do it. Okay. Mm. Yeah.
I think, so I would say, but, you know, again, I have to check with my copy of the GDPR, which is sat in the corner of my desk as ever.
I was going to say then you're not complying with the principle of retention because you're not.
God,
this gets complicated because I know I was going to say that only applies to controllers, but then you become a controller, but then you're not a controller in relation to that contract. So, yeah.
Anyway, I just thought I'd drop it in the conversation because it gets the brain working, doesn't it?
It does. I think on that argument, though, you know, it might specify that it's, you know, it should be in contract rather than specifying that you should do this, but I think that would definitely be implied by the ICO or the courts if that, you know, was to go further.
They would definitely have a view on it. But again, it might be that it's an edge case and, you know, there might be other circumstances
edge
where you
bets.
Might think, who said that?
We've not got much longer left in the session, but there's a couple of fines that I wanted to talk about. I'm sure some of you will have heard of them or around them, but the Irish Data Protection Commission has fined Meta again for €91 million for storing passwords in plain text. So
when were the storing passwords in plain text?
In 2019.
Still shouldn't have been doing it then, but that's a long time ago, isn't it? They shouldn't have fined now.
They shouldn't have, but I know, I don't know why the fine has taken so long, but at the same time, is this not a basic measure that should be in place to either encrypt the data or, you know, it's just stupid. It's absolutely stupid for an organisation of that size to be storing passwords in plain text. I don't understand if they've got any data protection team at all with all the, you know, the flack that they get in the news and the fines that they're receiving. Like, sure, it just baffles me. I don't get it.
I agree with you. I mean, it's a fundamental, isn't it? If you were providing a platform, you'd think that you'd have password security in place.
Yeah, absolutely stupid. Hayley said they just don't care. And you know what? I'd have to agree with you, to be honest. I think hopefully the amount that the fines are pocket change, hopefully they're accumulating to something now that will actually, you know, make them step up.
Meta have had quite a few, though, haven't they? Like you say, it's always the Irish Data Protection Commission as well that are issuing them. I'm sure they they're not fine met 300 million.
Not that long ago
as well, didn't they? Yeah. So, like you say, Jasmine, it's working its way up. I'm not sure how much money Meta has, but maybe one day they'll actually take note of these fines that they're getting rather than just batting it away.
I mean, is it the fact that it's American that hasn't in the past thought like EU law? You know, it's been thinking American law.
Probably maybe. In some ways, yeah. And you know what? I would have given that argument for certain breaches, but this is just a basic thing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any justification for it for Meta. No. But anyway, yeah. And then the other one, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, who had a breach. You know, that was last August, over a year ago.
Was it? Wow, crikey, time flies.
Baffles me. But so they, as part of a FOIA request, disclosed all of their staff's details. And, you know, I'm sure that most people have heard about it. It was on the news. Well, they've now been fined £750,000 by the ICO. It was reduced from 5.6 million because the public services reduction was applied for fines. Yeah.
Yeah, still unlike them to fine public authorities, isn't it? I think they've said there's a policy they're not going to. But they must have been taking a very dim view of this.
I feel like with this one, though, you can't really ignore it. I mean, I remember when it happened last year, and we covered it quite a bit, didn't we, on some of the sessions we had. And it was really, really concerning. And, you know, I think, Jasmine, you shared something with me from the ICO about the breach this week. And it was people were saying that they've had to leave jobs and they can't sleep at night. And so it has had a real adverse effect on the data subject. So even though the ICO are having a more relaxed approach to the public sector, I can't say it's a surprise that they fined them, but the public sector approach did reduce the fine. I think originally it was meant to be, was it 5.6, Jasmine
said,
5.6. but I remember when it happened at the time, I don't think it was necessarily a fine that I thought was probably the best way to go about it. I think more kind of like, if they're going to have this approach with public sector organizations because it's, you know, taking money from the taxpayer, why don't they do something else about it? Why don't they train staff? Why don't they put like workshops on for these organizations and get involved and go see them and do like an audit?
Speed awareness courses type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Just do something. If you're not, you know, if you're not going to fine them because you don't want to take money from the taxpayer, that's fine. But you can't just leave it alone. You can't just give them a reprimand, a slap on the wrist and ignore it. Surely they've got to have some sort of duty to go and make sure that these things don't happen again as a regulator.
Yeah,
I think that with this being so high profile, though, there probably would have been some level of outrage, even though it is backwards because it is based on taxpayers' money, if they didn't receive, you know, some sort of fine. But yeah, they issued a statement, I think it was two years ago, on their approach to public sector, non-compliances, I suppose. And it does say, you know, that they'll be working proactively with senior leaders across the public sector to encourage compliance, prevent harms before they occur, and learn lessons from things done wrong. So I'm not, truthfully speaking, I'm not entirely sure on what they've done. You know, I've not looked up on that at all. So
wonder if it's worth putting a FOIA request in. Would that work to find that out?
Probably.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Just on that, just before you move on, Phil, are you going to say something? But the public sector approach, I think it was a 2-year period, and that's up for, I think they said earlier in the year that they're going to, I believe it's autumn, that they're going to have a review and see if it's been effective. So that will be something that should come out towards the end of the year.
I was going to say that I saw something about FOIA and vexatious requests, which again was interesting. So somebody made a FOIA request to NLER, the train company, which is government owned at the moment, so it's a public authority, and NLER refused to comply. It was about painting colour a train in the LGBT plus colours. Anyway, LNER did some background research on the requester and found that they were transphobic and made all sorts of comments in public places. And therefore, they used that as a reason for refusing. They said it was a vexatious request. Anyway, this went to the Information Tribunal, and it got knocked back. Basically, they said, you know, you have to comply, but you can use this background information if you think it's relevant for demonstrating a FOIA request is vexatious. So you're talking about raising a request on the FOIA. They'll say, go, every time you're on the podcast, Joe Kirk, you're knocking us, so we think this is vexatious.
Yeah, maybe I won't. Maybe I'll ask Kane to put a FOIA request in then.
But the other thing I saw as well, which I know we're running out of time rapidly, that the ICO is targeting financial services companies for their approach to SARS. They said there's been a 15% increase in complaints about financial service companies doing SARS. So they've advised all financial service companies to do a SAR process audit and SAR process training internally, which is, again, quite interesting. They kind of singled out that industry and said, right, you know, we think, you know, given the statistics, this is what you ought to be doing about it.
No, that's positive. Good to see.
Yeah, and I'm talking about audits as well, because I mean, I'm really looking forward to this in a couple of weeks' time. We're doing our own internal audit training out with the GDPR. Are you doing that, Jazzy? You are, Joe, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah, so it's just it's a one day, isn't it? It's one day training how to do audits GDPR. So we're doing audit theory, and then we're going to apply it. I mean, I'm not delivering it. Lynn's delivering it, but I think it'll be quite a good session we're doing.
Yes, and I'm actually off on a couple of my first audits 2 days before that, actually. Me and you were off on site, aren't we, Phil? We've got about three or four coming up, haven't we, towards the end of the year. So I'm looking forward to that, actually, and maybe we can actually do a session on audits, because hopefully I'll have a breadth of new knowledge to share with everybody.
I've got six to do between now and Christmas.
Oh, wow.
Two are in Ireland, actually, so I'm quite looking forward to that.
No, not in Barcelona, though.
No, not in Barcelona.
Well, that is the hour mark, so I suppose if we're all done, we'll finish up. Thank you, everyone, for joining.
Abrupt ending.
Yeah. We just went quiet, so it's probably
we normally
like
fizzle
that.
Out. It's what you're doing next week, what you're doing the weekend, but no, Jasmine's obviously wanted
to
get the kettle
on. We never do that. No, I am hungry, to be fair. I'm surprised you can't hear my tummy even through this. But yeah, I hope everyone enjoys the weekend. We'll be back next week for a session on tracking and profiling, so keep an ear out for that one, because that'll be something that we've not really spoke about in great length on the podcast before, so quite excited for that. We'll be doing a lot of reading preparing for it.
Yes.
But yeah, in the meantime, we hope you all have a great weekend, and thanks for joining.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
See you later.
Bye.